AJ Products, we're dedicated to delivering intelligent solutions tailored for your business needs. Specializing in warehouse and project planning, we bring efficiency and sustainability to the forefront. To elevate your business, visit ajproducts.ie.
It's Wednesday, March the 6th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Farmer protest movements are becoming an increasingly important part of the political landscape across Europe, from Poland, where they have been spurred by the lifting of tariffs on Ukrainian agricultural produce, to the Netherlands, where government plans to cut nitrogen emissions have led to the rise of a significant new party, and most recently to Germany, where a threat to cut agricultural fuel subsidies has caused a furious reaction. In addition to these specific controversies, it does appear that European farmers as a whole believe that they are being ignored and their needs are being set aside. The ripples of all this are being felt across the EU in advance of June's Parliament elections. So what is exactly happening, and how likely is it that farmers' unhappiness could lead to new political parties in Ireland as well as in Europe? I'm joined by our Europe correspondent Naomi O'Leary and our political correspondent Jack Horgan-Jones. Hello to you both.
Hi, good to be with you.
Hi Hugh. Hi Naomi.
Naomi, I had a quick litany through there of some of the problems. There are other local problems in other countries as well. But is there a common thread across all these grievances?
Yeah, so the farmer protests tend to have some individual local particular issues, like you referred to, like the nitrogen emissions in the Netherlands or the specific border trade issues that there are with the countries that border Ukraine. But uniting them are some more large background grievances, which are common across Europe, really, which essentially boils down to increasing prices, the impact of inflation on input, stuff like fertilizer, things like that, and a feeling among farmers that the prices that they get paid for their produce doesn't reflect those rises and that they're being squeezed. And then on top of that, a resentment against a perceived tightening of rules. They essentially say, you know, just don't put any more rules on us, don't make us do anything else. And they feel that the industry is carrying an unfair burden for the policy priorities, particularly of the European Union.
Now, some listeners may ascribe this view to my own urban prejudices, but my thinking of the relationship with the EU and farmers is it has always both been fractious, but also very central to the EU itself. Farmers have wielded a huge amount of political power in the EU from the very start, and the common agricultural policy traditionally, but maybe from an Irish perspective, but I think more broadly than that, has been a crucial part of the EU's arrangements.
Yes, and that's very much still the case. It's kind of an unhealthy dependency. The common agricultural policy, which, you know, that's the phrase that's used to describe essentially the subsidies that farmers get, that accounts for a third of the EU's entire budget. It's the single biggest item. Part of the reason why it's such a large item is because it's one of the policy areas that the EU has agreed to do jointly. And that has created a situation where the agricultural industry is both very dependent on the EU and also it leads to these fractious relationships because gradually the EU has been trying to change this. Many countries are in favour of moving away from that, but our societies at large are sort of structured around this arrangement. It's reflected in our low food prices, for example. Consumers benefit from lower food prices because of this system of subsidies. And the system has ended up in a way that you might not want to have designed it to be in the first place. The whole thing grew out of a post-World War II aim to have food security in Europe. That was really important in that time. Then more recently, that policy, the cap, there's an attempt to try and change its effects because at different times in the past, it's favoured overproduction and particularly very intense production on the land. So meaning, for example, that farmers don't get paid unless they clear land of things like trees and scrub and what we now know are important natural ecosystems. And this is very much associated with the collapse of biodiversity that ultimately threatens farming itself. So now there's an attempt to retrofit essentially the policy to change its incentives so that it's in line with Europe's green goals. And this is where things can get really contentious.
And Jack, everything that Naomi says there is applicable, it seems to me, in spades, for want of a better word, to the Irish situation. Ireland's relationship from the very start with what was the common market and the EEC right through to the present day, farming has been extremely salient in that, probably out of proportion possibly to its role in the contemporary Irish economy.
Yeah, and by and large, you know, Irish farmers have been beneficiaries of the cap. And, you know, that may go some way towards supporting the kind of broad strokes political consensus in favour of the EU that has probably existed in Ireland since we joined. In more recent years, you might be forgiven for thinking that the farmers have forgotten the relationship between the money in their pocket and the European Union, because, you know, there has been a whole ream of issues which have been correctly or otherwise ascribed to interference from Brussels. And if not interference from Brussels, then more locally, the Green Party. So going back beyond the lifetime of this government, there was a pretty big farmer protest movement that sprang up around this kind of grassroots organization called the Beef Plan Movement in 2019, which led to some fairly significant protests of the style that we've seen on the streets of many European capitals. There were tractors parked up and down Kildare Street and, you know, protests at the Department of Agriculture offices here and associated traffic congestion for all the dubs. And that has kind of bled across into this government, as I say, with the Greens or the EU shouldering their fair share of the blame for things like the nature restoration directives, the issue of rural roads and investment in rural roads versus investment in public transport. You'll recall as well the controversy early in the lifetime of this government, over turf cutting. And then last year there was a controversy around the ending of a derogation that Ireland had arising from the nitrates directive. So all these things kind of go into this bundle of grievances that I suppose rural Ireland, or perhaps more properly farming voters, have. And that kind of leads people to suggest that, you know, there may be at least the potential here for a farmers party along the lines of what we've seen in other jurisdictions. And there was a lot of chatter around this last year when those shock results came in the Dutch elections. And around that time, there was some polling evidence to support that there is a large degree of latent support for such a party amongst farmers, with the Farmers Journal polling just under 2,000 farmers, 72% of whom said they would be highly likely to give a putative farmers party their first preference vote. I think that where the analysis kind of falls down a little bit, and maybe we can get into this later, is translating that kind of dislocation, which has a lot of commonalities with, you know, the kind of dynamic that Naomi has described as being in place across Europe, you know, a feeling that, you know, the mainstream politics is not out to further the interest or support the ambitions of rural Ireland. And, you know, closing that circle between that dislocation or sense of disaffection and that actually being given a voice in a parliamentary sense, and, you know, the chances of success for any farmers' party. We do actually have a farmers' party here. A farmers' alliance was set up, but it's really just a very small regional organisation in Donegal, where, you know, there already seems to have been a split between the founding members. So I wouldn't have any great hopes for that particular organisation going forward. The question, I suppose, really is how it interacts with the very large fourth force that exists alongside the three big political parties in Irish politics, that being the independent vote, and whether they can kind of mutually reinforce each other, whether they can cooperate, whether some independents might coalesce into some kind of farmers or rural grouping. And there is a new party already set up in the Dáil with three deputies, which is moving in that direction, or whether the strength of the independent brand and the attractions of being an independent brand will ultimately just end up eclipsing any hope of a farmers or rural party kicking up and actually generating momentum and results.
And the model for that, Naomi, really is the BBB in the Netherlands, isn't it? Which sort of came out of nowhere, did really successfully in the Netherlands regional elections, not so well in the general election when it happened, but, you know, remains a significant political force. There is a little bit of an Irish connection there. I think the leader's mother is Irish. They've visited here once or twice.
Yeah, so it's led by a woman called Caroline van der Plas, and her mother's called Nuala Fitzpatrick, and she's an Irish woman who moved to the Netherlands long, long ago. So yeah, this Farmers' Party started out doing exactly the kind of protests that we see now commonly across Europe. Everybody turning out on their tractors, shutting down city centres, besieging sometimes. They besieged The Hague at one point and the army had to get involved. And also throwing debris on the roads, so shutting down motorways. Exactly the kind of thing we now see happening in France and other places. So yeah, they've kind of had a widespread impact. That turned into a political party called the BBB Party in the Netherlands. And they, like you say, they really did very well in the Senate elections and regional elections, but in national elections, they got 7 seats, if I remember correctly. They are in talks to be part of the next government, which is expected to be a sort of a right-wing flavored government. So they may, you know, that kind of reflects the sense of momentum that people ascribe to them and the fact that they've entered parliament with, you know, a relatively strong showing for a Dutch party, you know, because Dutch politics is very fragmented. And it indicates they'll probably be, you know, at least what they want will be probably quite heavily favoured by the next government.
And what do they want?
The energising sort of, the thing that drove them most was the Netherlands, a bit like Ireland, where you were mentioning, had a derogation on nitrogen emissions and it hadn't come in line with the reduction of nitrogen emissions that it was supposed to under EU law. And this had to come from somewhere. It either meant a complete freeze to building in the Netherlands, which I think actually did happen temporarily, or it meant some farmers stopping farming. I think particularly the issue was pig farming, as I recall. Just the waste produced by pig farming is particularly intensive. But it fed into wider grievances and the sense that, you know, farmers weren't being allowed to farm. One of the sort of rallying cries was just let farmers farm, you know, and if you don't have farmers, you won't have food. It got a feeling of being underappreciated and driven off the land and things like that, or their job being made impossible. Now, having said that, one of the striking visual things to see when these farmer protests were going on was, you know, the sheer wealth that was displayed in these protests. I mean, the tractors that were being driven down the road were splendid vehicles that would cost huge amounts. And it's interesting because this is a part of society which has benefited from enormous public largesse. And in some ways, it was quite striking to see that. If you look at the statistics, farmers, particularly in the Netherlands, don't do that badly financially.
Yeah, and from what I know of the Netherlands and when I visited it, particularly you know, outside the cities, it's a kind of a miracle of high-intensity, industrial-style agricultural production, isn't it? I mean, from an economic perspective, purely economic perspective, it's a huge success. Mm-hmm. But these days, that does raise questions about the environmental impact.
Yeah, it's the intensity of the farming model that has been favoured by particularly CAP policies up until now is that's the real difficulty that the EU policymakers are now trying to turn around, like trying to turn around an oil tanker. It's incredibly difficult. How do you now change the incentives so that there are incentives for farmers to, for example, leave land fallow or allow hedgerows, not to have an incentive to take out hedgerows, for example, to leave small patches of forest to regenerate. That's what they're attempting to do. But, you know, the farming lobbies are incredibly powerful. These are one of the most powerful lobbies in the EU. And the protests by them and instigated by them are not a new phenomenon. It's, you know, gone on for decades because this is a section of society which has the apparatus at hand to create big disruption. So they can come with their tractors, they can dump slurry or hay or whatever it may be on the streets, and they will do it, and they have done it for years. So whenever there is a negotiation of the cap, they make sure that their voices are heard. It's also worth noting that, you know, not all farmers are the same, and different kinds of farming are more favoured in the cap than others. So there's a complexity to this that we shouldn't sort of lump all farmers together in a single block.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you about, Jack, because it's one of the things that always strikes me about this when we describe farmers as a sectoral interest. You know, the numbers show it's actually a very diverse range of people, huge economic inequalities between different types of farming and different types of the country. There are an awful lot of farmers who are essentially subsistence or below subsistence level in terms of the amount of income they get from their farms, or they're part-time farmers because they can't afford to make a living out of it. And then there is a very, very wealthy, again, high intensive dairy sector in particular, which generates huge profits for large corporations and also for large farmers. Their interests are not necessarily all the same, are they?
No, they're not. And I think the current split, insofar as I can tell, at least within cattle farming, is between, you know, those who are the cattle for slaughter and dairy farmers, with dairy farmers seemingly getting the better side of that coin at the moment. And I think that divergence, I suppose, has been traditionally reflected within Irish politics to an extent as well, where Fine Gael would usually have been seen as the party kind of more aligned with large landowners and larger farmers, and Fianna Fáil, as part of its more broad strokes appeal, would have aligned itself more closely with smaller landholders and smaller farmers. I mean, what's interesting at the moment, I suppose, is that the big kind of dynamic that exists within Irish politics since the last general election, which is the surge in support for Sinn Féin, albeit it's stuttering a little bit at the moment, it doesn't kind of copy and paste across to rural Ireland, or more specifically to farmers, into the same extent as it does model on the rest of the population. That Farmers Journal poll that I referenced a little while ago found just 12% support for Sinn Féin, which is a huge, huge, huge markdown on where they were polling nationally around last August, which in most polls was around 30%. So why that matters for the other large parties and for independent candidates is that it suggests that a large portion of the farming vote is still up for grabs. And I think that's why you see Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael particularly active in this space. And you could even see that at the ploughing championships, which is kind of the alpha and the omega of rural Ireland, the once a year convention that is, you know, a cross between you know, the electric picnic and an Irish Country Women's Association meeting with the bit of ploughing match thrown in, and all the mud that you might expect from all those things thrown in as well. Where Sinn Féin went down and Mary Lou McDonald gave a really quite cursory appearance, was barely available to the press. And despite having a big tent down there, they weren't really as much part of the kind of scene going around as the government parties, where there was huge amounts of ministers around pressing the flesh, doing doorstep opportunities. And I think that comes from a sense that, you know, a large part of rural Ireland feels disenfranchised. They're not going to Sinn Féin. They feel threatened by the Greens, so the two large parties of government feel that their votes are up for grab, and they're going to make a play for them. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how that maps onto the local and European elections, the extent to which they attack each other, to which they try and kind of suggest to rural Ireland that they are the party for them, but also how they moderate their criticism of the Green Party, who they're obviously coalition partners with, but are the bogeyman for rural Ireland and for many farmers. So, you know, the extent to which individual candidates, particularly at local level, are able to criticise the Green Party and the latitude with which HQ allows them to do that, I think will be something to watch, and could in turn play into inter-coalition tensions where, you know, there's no love lost on rural issues between a lot of government backbenchers and the Greens in government.
Just one quick question before we go for our break, Jack. You know, we sometimes interchangeably use the words rural Ireland and farmers. Sinn Féin are doing pretty well in large parts of rural Ireland. And so there seems to be, there's a kind of an identification with farmers. People who are interested in farmers' issues are not necessarily working a farm themselves, are they? So it's a kind of it's a cultural representation of where people are from, as well as what they might necessarily make their living out of. Although they may be operating in an economy where they rely on farmers doing well too, if you're a local shopkeeper or something, for example.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point, actually, because it's an interesting one to tease out a little bit. Yes, so, you know, a lot of people, and I think there is a distinction, albeit perhaps a kind of subtle one, to be drawn between what might be traditionally seen as rural Ireland, or at least, you know, non-kind of large urban centre Ireland, and farming Ireland or the farming vote. I think that you're right in the first instance that, you know, large amounts of the wider rural communities who may not be farmers themselves at least have an identification alignment with farming or farming issues, or a direct economic interest in the farming sector. But there's also another dynamic playing out as well, which is that, you know, large amounts of what you might imagine to be rural Ireland are kind of more urban than you might imagine as well. You know, like in the larger towns that are dotted around Ireland, you'd see a lot of the same issues that kind of animate voters in the larger urban centres. You know, the same issues of access to services, the same issues of housing and quality of service provision. So I think just the risk, I suppose, particularly for the Irish Times Politics podcast and the coastal elite that it represents, is to tar all of rural/farming Ireland with the same brush and to presume that that it operates as one cohesive block, whereas actually it's probably far more complex than that in real life.
Yeah, you're right. We should check our prejudices at the door on this one. Let's take a quick break and we'll be back after this.
At AJ Products, we're dedicated to delivering intelligent solutions tailored exclusively for your business needs. Spanning offices, warehouses, industries, workshops, schools and public spaces. Specialising in warehouse and project planning, we bring efficiency and sustainability to the forefront. Our offerings include versatile storage solutions and comprehensive office project design and implementation. With over 45 years of experience, we stand as your trusted partner in smart B2B solutions. To explore all we have to offer, visit ajproducts.ie and elevate your business with AJ Products.
Welcome back. Naomi and Jack are still with us. Naomi, Jack was talking before the break about sort of the cultural profile of rural Ireland. My impression would be that a movement like a farmers' movement is traditionally small C conservative. Obviously, there's an interest in, you know, maintaining land ownership and not having that overtaxed. There's a little bit of a paradox there because of the reliance on subsidies, which you mentioned earlier. But is this broadly, if you're translating it from taking the tractors off the streets and turning it into votes and ballot boxes, a populist right movement?
There are certainly populist right elements. There's no doubt about that. I think we need to look at this as part of the history that we've seen since the Gilets Jaunes or Yellow Vest protest in France, if you remember that. That was in response to rising fuel prices. It was a feeling of kind of the rural left behind people. And it frightened a lot of governments. Then the BBB, for example, the farmer protests in the Netherlands, there's quite a lot of overlap there between what was going on also in US and North American politics at the time as well. Listeners may remember there was something called the Freedom Convoy, which was all of these trucks that were protesting against vaccine mandates. And then it sort of spiraled into like larger scale anti-COVID restriction protests with trucks taking over the road and beeping. These things were happening simultaneously, and they were also, it's quite international as well. For example, a kind of a figurehead of the farmers' movement in the Netherlands is a lady called Eva Vlaardingerbroek, and she was invited on Tucker Carlson repeatedly, you know, the US pundit, and there the farmers' protests were sort of, they were shown as being a European version of what was going on in the United States with, you know, sort of libertarian protests and anti-COVID movement and so on, kind of against the government interference and so on. So there's definitely a sort of populist, a radical right flavor to much of this. And that links into the anti-green politics that motivates at least some of it. So you have the kind of traditional farmers, lobbyists as well, and the more small C conservative elements, but then it has its own unique flavor, and this is kind of why it's scaring the center right so much at the moment. A lot of the reaction of the more centrist political parties to the growth of these movements and the protests is fear driven, and the reaction is that they don't want to seem too green for fear of losing their votes to these people.
Because we have seen, haven't we, politicians from Alternative for Deutschland, for example, in Germany, latching on to these farmer protests in Germany. And you can see how for any political entrepreneur, you mentioned America, you only have to look at the red state, blue state divide there, the way in which, whether you're in an urban or a rural area, seems to dictate, you know, which way your vote is going to go, that there's an opportunity for a populist right party there.
There's a definite culture war element to it. So what we've seen is, in anticipation of an expected shift to the right, particularly in European elections in June, we've seen a number of like key concessions. It started off with Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, announcing that the protection status of wolves would be downgraded. This was, you know, there have been conservation efforts that have been relatively successful, basically bringing back wolves from the brink of extinction. And there are farmers' movements rurally, particularly in Germany and France, that had been saying that too many of their sheep were being killed and lobbying for the protection of wolves to be reduced. So that was done. That was one of the sort of first, the commission recommended doing that. And it was one of the first sort of concessions. It's an issue that's you know, it affects relatively few people, but it was a sort of a, it was like something that has a very strong image and is symbolic in a way. And
it was a kind of a culture war thing,
yeah,
wasn't
exactly.
it? Because, as you say, it affected very few people, but it's symbolic. I mean, there was complete horror in Ireland, I think, when Eamon Ryan suggested this a few years ago. But Ursula von der Leyen wasn't very happy about it either. Did she have a run-in with a wolf somewhere? Or
oh, yeah.
Some animal got killed by a wolf.
A wolf killed her pony. Yeah, her beloved pony was actually killed by a wolf. Yeah, so it's personal for her.
The whole thing is like a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. But anyway.
Yeah. But then, since then, I mean, we've just seen how it's quite amazing how quickly concessions can come. You know, France had a plan to phase out some fuel subsidies, which was very hastily reversed in the face of, you know, farmers shutting down roads and things like that. And in the European Parliament, it's been particularly evident how the centre-right group has turned on what was part of it was partly its idea, you know, the part of the Green Deal legislation, part of the plan to get the EU, to get Europe as a continent to meet its climate change goals, which it committed to internationally in an attempt to avoid catastrophic levels of climate change. There's now been an attempt to sort of slowly unpick parts of that or water them down, particularly with the Nature Restoration Law. It's worth pointing out that both with the Nature Restoration Law and with CAP, the form of watering down that usually comes is that is more power for national governments to interpret the laws and to shape them to national circumstances. So very few details are sort of set centrally in Brussels and everything is adapted according to national plans. And there you have the ability for governments to either be more ambitious or very much less so, depending on how they interpret it and I suppose the political pressures that they feel at home.
Yeah, and when I look at this in an Irish context, again, Jack, I mean, you mentioned the Farmers Alliance earlier. I had a look at their website, and there's all the views that you would express about them resisting things like, you know, some of the restrictions on turf cutting and various elements like that. But there's also there's a section about immigration, which says we have open borders. There's those types of culture war issues there as well. They don't seem to have got a lot of prominence among the kind of rural independents who would constitute the current representation for these positions in Ireland, do they? In a way, is there, I think Pat Leahy has suggested this, is the power of the independent TD in Ireland a sort of an inoculation against a mass populist right party?
Well, I think it's a hurdle that all sorts of aspiring political groupings have to clear, whether it's, you know, a far right or a farmers grouping or whatever, because the fact of the matter is that being an independent TD in Ireland comes with a whole suite of benefits. Chiefly, you know, you don't have to kowtow with any party whip, you don't have to subscribe to any wider set of policies, and you can build in some instances, multi-decade career. In other instances, you can build entire dynasties, such as the Healy Ray clan, around the idea of being an independent voice and constructing kind of quasi-patronage networks, or at least, you know, being the local voice in the Dáil. And exploiting that, particularly around elections, you know, Michael Healy Ray is the most prominent example of that now. But going back through history and not confined to rural TDs, you know, there has been many examples of independent TDs maximizing their position when they hold the balance of power after elections to gain huge dividends for their local areas and for their constituencies. So I suppose the question is, it's not whether the underlying conditions exist that could give rise to a farmers' party or a rural party or something like that. It's if you're already a successful independent TD, why would you bother? You know, you probably already have a very, you know, wide and effective network of supporters. You have a good constituency organization. And you're totally unshackled by having to, as I say, you know, be aligned with any party whip or subscribe to any particular set of policies.
I suppose that what you might bother is if there was an issue that was big enough for people to get really angry about on a single issue basis, like the nitrogen thing in the Netherlands, or I was talking to somebody in Donegal who told me absolute confidence that there'd be at least two micro-redress TDs coming out of Donegal at the next general election. Now, that's a relatively regional issue, but if there was something like that, might that mobilise a more of a movement?
I mean, I think it could mobilize independence. Yeah, but again, I don't see why they would then burden themselves with all the different kind of parts of you know, being in a party and all the apparatus that requires you to subscribe to, particularly when they can get all speaking time and other kind of, you know, organizational perks by forming technical speaking groups. You know, like, sure. There are
so the incentives work in a very particular way.
There's an alignment of incentives very different from elsewhere there for independent TDs that I think kind of, if not fatally, undermines the chances of a rural or farmers party emerging. It certainly is a counterweight to the kind of the logic that would suggest that just because there is alienation and indignation within rural Ireland at mainstream politics and the Greens and the EU and all the rest of it, you know, that necessarily translates directly into a presumption that there's going to be a party in that vein, much as there is, you know, certainly more pronounced concern about migration and immigration in Ireland than there has been certainly at any time in the last couple of political generations. Sure. But that doesn't necessarily suggest that there's going to be an electorally successful far right or right wing or migration skeptical party.
The evidence is not there for the moment. Yeah, sure. But Naomi, it's quite different, it seems to me, in European politics. We can actually see this having an effect already, can't we? As you've mentioned, and you've written very interestingly about this for the last while, as the centre-right parties move to counter what they see as this threat, maybe a combined threat, on the one hand from farmer protests and on the other hand from the populist right, that they are quite clearly shifting to the right and resiling from some of their previous commitments on the climate and nature restoration side. Well, we're seeing those policy changes right now, aren't we?
That's right. So it's essentially what polls forecast is there will be a shift to the right in the next European Parliament, and that it also may be more fragmented. It may be more difficult for bills to pass. This has a huge implication for the EU's ability to legislate, because bills do need to be approved in the European Parliament. Usually up until now, or up until recently, the Parliament has pushed for more ambitious legislation, particularly on things like green stuff or progressive. That was traditionally how it was, but that's very much changed now. Key to the change is the European People's Party. That's the largest political bloc in the EU. Fine Gael is part of it. It's, I suppose, particularly in Germany and France, they see the rural small C conservative voters as their natural voting bloc. So they're quite on the defensive from the growth of the likes of the AFD and that rural populist vote that we've been talking about. So in response to that, the current leader of the European People's Party, Manfred Weber, a German politician, he personally led a campaign to kill off the nature restoration law. He wanted it to be rejected outright. That actually failed, partly due to a rebellion by Fine Gael. Their 5 votes, which didn't go along with the rest of their party, were almost entirely responsible for that effort failing, which has actually led to them being a little bit alienated within their own political party. But that's another story. And there's quite interesting personal politics behind this as well, because Manfred Weber, when he was kind of going to war on the nature restoration law and parts of the Green Deal in general, what he was really doing was unpicking part of Ursula von der Leyen's project. This was, you know, part of her, it was a pillar of her policy aims for her term as European Commission president. The two of them are in the same party. They're both German EPP politicians, but they're rivals. And Manfred Weber was actually overlooked for Ursula von der Leyen's job. He was supposed to be the man who was actually Commission president if things had gone the way that they had been sketched out in advance. But that was scuppered by backroom dealing in 2019 between the leaders of EU countries. So there's a kind of an interesting backstory to it. But what we do see is increasingly there's expectations that the centre-right will either have to rely on the votes of the hard right or will choose to do so and choose to go into alliances with that in order to keep their power, because large delegations are expected to be voted in from Germany, France and other countries, Italy. And the centre-right, the EPP, they're expected to still be the largest bloc, but to be somewhat smaller. And for the arithmetic of how majorities are passed in the European Parliament to be slightly different and to perhaps require this kind of deal making. It's almost overwhelmingly focused on green issues. That is where the hardest pressure is coming to pass. It's anti-green politics trying to water down green environmental issues. For some reason, these seem to have become kind of totemic and, like I say, a bit of a culture war issue. And the EPP is above all afraid of seeming too green to their voters. That's what they think they need to resist.
Well, we leave it there for the moment. Thanks very much to Naomi for joining us, and also to Jack too. We'll be back with you very soon indeed. Our producer was Declan Conlon. We'll be back with you on Friday with The Wrap. Thank you for listening.